Chapter 4 Carousel New Brasilia, Yellowstone, Epsilon Eridani, 2546. Volyova disembarked from the light hugger's shuttle and followed Triumvir Hegazi down the exit tunnel. Via twisting gaskets, the tunnel led them into the weightless hub of a spherical transit lounge at the heart of the carousel. Every fractured strain of humanity was there, a bewildering free-floating riot of color, like tropical fish in a feeding frenzy. Ultras, skyjacks, conjoiners, demarchists, local traders, intrasystem passengers, freeloaders, mechanics, all following what seemed to be completely random trajectories, but never quite colliding, no matter how perilously close they came. Some, where their body plans allowed it, had diaphanous wings sewn under their sleeves or attached directly to the skin. The less adventurous made do with slim thrust packs or allowed themselves to be pulled along by tiny rented tugs. Personal servitors flew through the throng, carrying baggage and folded spacesuits, while liveried winged capuchin monkeys foraged for litter, tucking what they found into marsupial pouches under their chests. Chinese music tinkled pervasively through the air, sounding to Volyova's untutored ear like wind chimes stirred by a breeze with a particular taste for dissonance. Yellowstone, thousands of kilometers below, was an ominous yellow-brown backdrop to all this activity. Volyova and Hegazi reached the far side of the transit sphere and moved through a matter-permeable membrane into a customs area. It was another free-fall sphere, wall festooned with autonomic weapons which tracked each arrival. Transparent bubbles filled the central volume, each 3 meters wide and split open along an equatorial bisector. Sensing the newcomers, two bubbles drifted through the airspace and clumped themselves around them. A small servitor hung inside Volyova's bubble, shaped like a Japanese kabuto helmet, with various sensors and readout devices projecting from beneath the rim. She felt a neural tingle as the thing trawled her, like someone daintily rearranging flowers in her head. "I detect residual Russish linguistic structures, but determine that modern Norte is your standard tongue. Will this suffice for bureaucratic processing?"
"It'll do," Volyova said, miffed that the thing had detected the rustiness of her native language.
"Then I shall continue in Norte. Apart from reefer sleep mediation systems, I detect no cerebral implants or exosomatic perceptual modification devices. Do you require the loan of an implant before the continuation of this interview?"
"Just give me a screen and a face."
"Very well."
A face resolved beneath the rim. The face was female and white, with just a hint of Mongolism, hair as short as Volyova's own. She guessed that Hegazi's interviewer would appear male, mustached, dark-skinned and heavily chimeric, just like the man himself.
"State your identity,"
the woman said. Volyova introduced herself. "You last visited this system in... let me see." The face looked down for a moment. 85 years ago. 461. Am I correct?" Against her best instincts, Volyova leaned nearer the screen.
"Of course you're correct. You're a gamma-level simulation. Now dispense with the theatrics and just get on with it. I've wares to trade, and every second you detain me is a second more we have to pay to park our ship around your useless dog-turd of a planet."
"Truculence noted,"
the woman said, seeming to jot a remark in a notebook just out of sight. "For your information, Yellowstone records are incomplete in many areas, owing to the data corruption of the plague. When I asked you the question, I did so because I wanted to confirm an unverified record." She paused.
"And by the way, my name is Vavilov.
I'm sitting with a rancid cup of coffee and my last cigarette in a drafty office 8 hours into a 10-hour shift. My boss will assume I was dozing if I don't turn back 10 people today, and so far I've only notched up 5. With 2 hours to go, I'm looking at ways to fill my quota, so please, think very carefully before your next outburst." The woman took a drag and blew the smoke in Volyova's direction.
"Now, shall we continue?"
"I'm sorry, I thought..."
Volyova trailed off.
"Your people don't use simulations for this kind of work?"
"We used to,"
Vavilov said, with a long, suffering sigh. "But the trouble with simulations is that they put up with far too much shit."
From the carousel's hub, Volyova and Hegazi rode a house-sized elevator down one of the wheel's four radial spokes, their weight mounting until they reached the circumference. Gravity there was Yellowstone normal, not perceptibly different to the standard Earth gravity adopted by Ultras. Carousel New Brasilia orbited Yellowstone every 4 hours, in an orbit which meandered to avoid the rust belt, the debris rings which had come into existence since the plague. It had a wheel configuration, one of the commonest carousel designs. This one was 10 kilometers in diameter and 1,100 meters wide. All human activity wound on the 30-kilometer strip around the wheel. It was sufficient size for a scattering of towns, small hamlets, and bonsai landscape features, even a few carefully horticultured forests, with azure snow-capped mountains carved into the rising valley sides of the strip to give the illusion of distance. The curved roof around the concave part of the wheel was transparent, rising 0.5 kilometer above the strip. Metal rails were fretted across its surface, from which hung billowing artificial clouds, choreographed by computer. Apart from simulating planetary weather, the clouds served to break up the upsetting perspectives of the curved world. Volyova supposed they were realistic, but having never seen real clouds with her own eyes, at least not from below, she could not be wholly sure. They had emerged from the elevator onto a terrace above the carousel's main community, a collision of buildings piled between stepped valley sides. Rim Town, they called it. It was an eyesore of architectural styles reflecting the succession of different tenants which the carousel had enjoyed throughout its history. A line of rickshaws waited at ground level, the driver of the closest quenching his thirst from a can of banana juice, which sat in a holder rigged to the taxi's handlebars. Hegazi passed the driver a piece of paper marked with their destination. The driver held it closely to his black, close-set eyes, then grunted acknowledgement. Soon they were trundling through the traffic, electric and pedal vehicles barging recklessly around each other, pedestrians diving bravely between openings in the seemingly random flow. At least half the people Volyova saw were ultranauts, evidenced by their tendency towards paleness, spindly build, flaunted body augmentations, swathes of black leather and acres of glinting jewelry, tattoos and trade trophies. None of the ultras she saw were extreme chimerics, with the possible exception of Hegazi, who probably qualified as one of the half-dozen most augmented people in the carousel. But the majority wore their hair in the customary ultra manner, fashioned in thick braids to indicate the number of reefer-sleep stretches they had done, and many of them had their clothes slashed to expose their prosthetic parts. Looking at these specimens, Volyova had to remind herself that she was part of the same culture. Ultras, of course, were not the only space-going factions spawned by humanity. Skyjacks, at least here, made up a significant portion of the others she saw. They were space dwellers, to be sure, but they did not crew interstellar ships, and so their outlook was very different to the wraith-like ultras, with their dreadlocks and old-fashioned expressions. There were others still. Icecombers were a skyjack offshoot, psycho-modified for the extreme solitude which came from working the Kuiper Belt zones, and they kept themselves to themselves, with ferocious dedication. Gillies were aquatically modified humans who breathed liquid air, capable of crewing short-range, high-G ships. They constituted a sizable fraction of the system's police force. Some gillies were so incapable of normal respiration and locomotion that they had to move around in huge robotic fish tanks when not on duty. And then there were conjoiners, descendants of an experimental clique on Mars who had systematically upgraded their minds, swapping cells for machines, until something sudden and drastic had happened. In one moment, they had escalated to a new mode of consciousness, what they called the Trans-Enlightenment, precipitating a brief but nasty war in the process. Conjoiners were easy to pick out in crowds. Recently they had bioengineered huge and beautiful cranial crests for themselves, veined to dissipate the excess heat produced by the furious machines in their heads. There were fewer of them these days, so they tended to draw attention. Other human factions, like the Demarchists, who had long allied themselves with the conjoiners, were acutely aware that only conjoiners knew how to build the engines which powered lighthuggers.
Stop here, Hegazi said. The rickshaw darted to the street side, where wizened old men sat at folding tables playing card games and mahjong. Hegazi slapped payment into the driver's fleshy palm, and then followed Valiova on to the street side. They had arrived at a bar. The juggler and the shrouder, Valiova said, reading the holographic sign above the door. It showed a naked man emerging from the sea, backdropped by strange phantasmagoric shapes among the surf. Above him, a black sphere hung in the sky.
This doesn't look right. It's where all the others hang out. You'd better get used to it.
All right, point made. I suppose I wouldn't feel at home in any ultra bar, come to think of it.
You wouldn't feel at home in anything that didn't have a navigational system and a lot of nasty firepower, Ilya.
Sounds like a reasonable definition of common sense to me.
Youths barged out into the street, plastered in sweat and what Valiova hoped was spilt beer. They had been arm wrestling. One of their number was nursing a prosthetic which had ripped off at the shoulder. Another was riffling a wad of notes he must have won inside. They had the regulation sleep stretch locks and the standard issue star effect tattoos, making Valiova feel simultaneously ancient and envious. She doubted that their anxieties extended much beyond the troubling question of where their next drink or bed was coming from. Hegazi gave them a look. He must have seemed intimidating to them, even given their chimeric aspirations, since it was difficult to tell which parts of Hegazi were not mechanical.
Come on, he said, pushing through the disturbance. Grin and bear it, Ilya.
It was dark and smoky inside, and with the combined synergistic effects of the noise from the music, pulsing Burundi rhythms, overlaid with something that might have been human singing, and the perfumed, mild hallucinogens in the smoke, it took Valiova a few moments to get her bearings. Then Hegazi pointed to a miraculously spare table in the corner, and she followed him to it with the minimum of enthusiasm.
You're going to sit down, aren't you?
I don't suppose I have much choice.
We have to look as if we at least tolerate each other's company, or people will get suspicious.
Hegazi shook his head, grinning.
I must like something about you, Ilya. Otherwise I'd have killed you ages ago.
She sat down.
Don't let Sojaki hear you talking like that.
He doesn't take kindly to threats being made against Triumvir members.
I'm not the one who has a problem with Sojaki, in case you forgot. Now, what are you drinking?
Something my digestive system can process.
Hegazi ordered some drinks. His physiology allowed that, waiting until the overhead delivery system brought them.
You're still annoyed by that business with Sujik, aren't you?
Don't worry. Valiova said, crossing her arms. Sujik isn't anything I can't handle.
Besides, I'd be lucky to lay a finger on her before Sojaki finished her off. He might let you have second pickings.
The drinks arrived in a little perspex cloud with a flip-top, the cloud suspended from a trolley which ran along rails mounted on the ceiling.
You think he'd actually kill her?
Valiova attacked her drink, glad of something to wash away the dust of the rickshaw ride.
I wouldn't trust Sojaki not to kill any of us, if it came to that. You used to trust him. What made you change your mind?
Sojaki hasn't been the same since the captain fell ill again.
She looked around nervously, well aware that Sojaki might not be very far from earshot.
Before that happened, they both visited the jugglers. Did you know that? You're saying the jugglers did something to Sojaki's mind?
She thought back to the naked man stepping from the juggler ocean.
That's what they do, Hegazi. Yes, voluntarily. Are you saying Sojaki chose to become crueler?
Not just cruel. Single-minded. This business with the captain.
She shook her head.
It's emblematic.
Have you spoken to him recently?
She read his question.
No, I don't think he's found who he's looking for. Though doubtless we'll find out shortly.
And your own quest?
I'm not looking for a specific individual. My only constraint is that whoever I find should be saner than Boris Nagorny. That ought not to pose any great difficulties.
She let her gaze drift around the drinkers in the bar. Although none of the people looked definitely psychotic, neither was there anybody who exactly looked stable and well-adjusted.
At least I hope not.
Agassi lit a cigarette and offered Volyova a second. She took it gratefully and smoked it solidly for 5 minutes, until it resembled a glowing speck of fissile material wrapped in glowing embers. She made a mental note to replenish her supply of cigarettes during this stopover. "But my search is only just beginning," she said, "and I have to handle it delicately."
"You mean," Agassi said with a knowing smile, "that you're not actually going to tell people what the job is before you recruit them?"
Volyova smirked. "Of course not." The sapphire-hulled shuttle he was riding had not come far, only a short interorbital hop from the Sylvestre's familial habitat. Even so, it had been difficult to arrange. Calvin strongly disapproved of his son having any contacts with the thing which now resided in the Institute, as if the thing's state of mind might infect Sylvestre by some mysterious process of sympathetic resonance. Yet Sylvestre was 21. He chose his own associations now. Calvin could go hang, or burn his neurons to ash in the madness he was about to inflict on himself and his 79 disciples. But he was not going to dictate who Sylvestre could see. He saw SISS looming ahead, and thought, "None of this is real. Just a narrative strand from his biography." Pascal had given him the rough cut and asked for his comments. Now he was experiencing it, still walled in his prison in Cuvier, but moving like a ghost through his own past, haunting his younger self. Memories, long buried, were welling up unbidden. The biography, still far from complete, would be capable of being accessed in many ways, from many viewpoints, and with varying degrees of interactivity. It would be an intricately faceted thing, detailed enough that one could easily spend more than a lifetime exploring only a segment of his past. SISS looked as real as he remembered. The Sylvestre Institute for Shrouder Studies had its organizational center in a wheel-shaped structure dating from the Americano days, although there was not a single cubic nanometer which had not been reprocessed many times over the intervening centuries. The wheel's hub sprouted two gray mushroom-shaped hemispheres, pocked with docking interfaces and the modest defense systems permitted by the Demarchist ethics. The wheel's edge was a hectic accretion of living modules, labs and offices, embedded in a matrix of bulk chitin polymer, linked by a tangle of access tunnels and supply pipes, walled in shark collagen.
"It's good. You think so?"
Pascal's voice was distant.
"That's how it was," Sylvestre said, "how it felt when I visited him.
Thanks, Well, this was nothing. The easy part. Fully documented. We had blueprints for SISS, and there are even some people in Cuvier who knew your father, like Janekin. The hard part's what happened afterwards, where we have so little to go on except what you told them on your return.
I'm sure you've done an excellent job of it."
"Well, you'll see, sooner rather than later."
The shuttle coupled with the docking interface. Institute security servitors were waiting beyond the lock, validating his identity.
"Calvin won't be thrilled," said Grigori, the Institute's housekeeper, "but I suppose it's too late to send you home now."
They had been through this ritual 2 or 3 times in the last few months, Grigori always washing his hands of the consequences. It was no longer necessary to have someone escort Sylvestre through the shark collagen tunnels to the place where they kept him, the thing.
"You've got nothing to worry about, Grigori. If Father gives you any trouble, just tell him I ordered you to show me around."
Grigori arched his eyebrows, the emotionally attuned entoptics around him registering amusement.
"Isn't that just what you're doing, then?"
"I was trying to keep things amicable."
"Utterly futile, dear boy. We'd all be much happier if you just followed your father's lead. You know where you are with a good totalitarian regime."
It took 20 minutes to navigate the tunnels, moving radially outwards to the rim, passing through scientific sections where teams of thinkers, human and machine, grappled endlessly with the central enigma of the shrouds. Although SISS had established monitoring stations around all the shrouds so far discovered, most of the information processing and collating took place around Yellowstone. Here, elaborate theories were assembled and tested against the facts, which were scant, but unignorable, No theory had lasted more than a few years. The place where they kept him, the thing Sylvester had come to see, was a guarded annex on the rim, a generously large allocation of volume, given the lack of evidence that the thing within was actually capable of appreciating the gift. The thing's name, his name, was Philip Lascelles. He did not have many visitors now. There had been lots in the early days, shortly after his return, but interest had dwindled when it became clear that Lascelles could tell his inquisitors nothing, useful or otherwise. But, as Sylvester had quickly appreciated, the fact that no one paid Lascelles much attention these days could actually work to his advantage. Even Sylvester's relatively infrequent visits, once or twice a month, had been sufficiently far from the norm to enable a kind of rapport to form between the two of them, between himself and the thing Lascelles had become. Lascelles' annex contained a garden, under an artificial sky glazed the deep blue of cobalt. A breeze had been created, sufficient to finger the wind chimes suspended from the bower of overarching trees which fringed the garden. The garden had been landscaped with paths, rockeries, knolls, trellises, and goldfish ponds, the effect being of a rustic maze, so that it always took a minute or so to find Lascelles. When Sylvester did find him, the man was usually in the same state, naked or half-naked, filthy to some degree, his fingers smeared with the rainbow shades of crayons and chalks. Sylvester would always know he was getting warm when he saw something scrawled on the stone path, either a complex symmetrical pattern or what looked like an attempt at mimicking Chinese or Sanskrit calligraphy, without actually knowing any real letters. At other times the things which Lascelles marked on the path looked like Boolean algebra or semaphore. Then, it was always only a question of time, he would round a corner and Lascelles would be there, working on another marking, or carefully erasing one he had worked on previously. His face would be frozen in a rictus of total concentration, and every muscle in his body would be rigid with the exertion of the drawing, and the process would take place in complete silence, except for the stirring of the wind chimes, the quiet whisper of the water, or the scraping of his crayons and chalks against stone. Sylvester would often have to wait hours for Lascelles to even register his presence, which would generally amount to nothing more than the man turning his face to him for an instant before continuing. Yet the same thing always happened in that instant. The rictus would soften, and in its place would be, if only for a moment, a smile, one of pride or amusement, or something utterly beyond Sylvester's fathoming. And then Lascelles would return to his chalks, and there would be nothing to suggest that this was a man, the only human being, to ever touch the surface of a shroud and return alive. "Anyway," Bolyova said, quenching what remained of her thirst, "I'm not expecting it to be easy, but I have no doubts that I will find a recruit sooner or later. I have begun to advertise, stating our planned destination. As far as the work is concerned, I say only that it requires someone with implants."
"But you're not going to take the first one that comes along," Hegazi said.
"Surely."
"Of course not. Though they won't know it, I'll be vetting my candidates for some kind of military experience in their backgrounds. I don't want someone who's going to crack up at the first hint of trouble, or someone unwilling to submit to discipline." She was beginning to relax now, after all her difficulties with Nagorny. A girl was playing on stage, working a gold tikhonax through endlessly spiraling ragas. Volyova did not greatly care for music, never had done. But there was something mathematically beguiling about the music which, for a moment, worked against her prejudices. She said, "I'm confident of success. We need only concern ourselves with Sajaki." At that moment Agazi nodded towards the door, where bright daylight forced Volyova to squint. A figure stood there, majestically silhouetted in the glare. The man was garbed in a black ankle-length cloak and a vaguely defined helmet, the light making it resemble a halo cast around his head. His profile was split diagonally by a long, smooth stick which he gripped two-handedly. The Komuso stepped into the darkness. What looked like a kendo stick was only his bamboo shakuhachi, a traditional musical instrument. With well-rehearsed rapidity he slid the thing into a sheath concealed behind the folds of his cloak. Then, with imperial slowness,
He removed the wicker helmet. The Komuso's face was difficult to make out. His hair was brilliantined, slickly tied back in a scythe-shaped tail. His eyes were lost behind sleek assassin's goggles, infrared-sensitive facets dully catching the room's tinted light. The music had come to an abrupt stop, the girl with the tikonax vanishing magically from the stage.
"They think it's a police bust,"
Egazi breathed, the room quiet enough now that he didn't need to raise his voice. "The local cops send in the basket cases when they don't want to bloody their own hands." The Kamusa swept the room, fly-like eyes targeting the table where Egazi and Volyova sat. His head seemed to move independently of the rest of his body, like some species of owl. With the bustle of his cloak, he cruised towards them, appearing to glide more than locomote. Nonchalantly, Egazi kicked a spare seat out from under the table, simultaneously taking an unimpressed drag on his cigarette.
"Good to see you, Sajake."
He dropped the wicker helmet next to their drinks, ripping the goggles away from his eyes as he did so. He lowered himself into the vacant chair, then turned casually around to the rest of the bar. He made a drinking gesture, imploring the people to get on with their own business, while he attended to his. Gradually the conversation rumbled back into life, although everyone was keeping half an eye on the three of them.
"I wish the circumstances merited a celebratory drink," Sajaki said.
"They don't,"
Egazi said, looking as crestfallen as his extensively modified face permitted.
"No, most certainly not."
Sajaki examined the nearly spent glasses on the table and lifted Volyova's, downing the few drops which remained.
"I've been doing some spying, as you might gather from my disguise. Silvest isn't here. He isn't in this system anymore. As a matter of fact, he hasn't been here for somewhere in the region of 50 years.
50 years?
Egazi whistled. "That's quite a cold trail," Volyova said. She tried not to sound gloating, but she had always known this risk existed. When Sajaki had given the order to steer the Lighthugger towards the Yellowstone system, he had done so on the basis of the best information available to him at the time. But that was decades ago, and the information had been decades old even when he received it.
"Yes," Sajaki said, "but not as cold as you might think. I know exactly where he went to, and there's no reason to assume he's ever left the place."
"And where would this be?"
Volyova asked, with a sinking feeling in her stomach.
"A planet called Resurgam."
Sajaki placed Volyova's glass down on the table.
"It's quite some distance from here, but I'm afraid, dear colleagues, that it must be our next port of call."
He fell into his past again. Deeper, this time, back to when he was 12. Pascal's flashbacks were non-sequential. The biography was constructed with no regard for the niceties of linear time. At first he was disoriented, even though he was the one person in the universe who ought not to have been adrift in his own history. But the confusion slowly gave way to the realization that her way was the right one, that it was right to treat his past as a shattered mosaic of interchangeable events, an acrostic embedded with numerous, equally legitimate interpretations. It was 2373. Only a few decades after Bernst Dottier's discovery of the first shroud. Whole academic disciplines had sprung up around the central mystery, as well as numerous government and private research agencies. The Silvest Institute for Shrouder Studies was only one of dozens of such organizations, but it also happened to be backed by one of the wealthiest and most powerful families in the whole human bubble. But when the break came, it was not via the calculated moves of large scientific organizations. It was through one man's random and dedicated madness. His name was Philippe Lascaille. He was an SISS scientist, working at one of the permanent stations near what was now called Lascaille Shroud, in the Trans-Tau Ceti sector. Lascaille was also one of a team kept on permanent standby should there ever be a need for human delegates to travel to the Shroud, although no one considered that this was very likely. But the delegates existed, with a ship kept in readiness to carry them the remaining 500 million kilometers to the boundary, should the invitation ever arrive. Lascaille decided not to wait. Alone, he boarded and stole the SISS contact craft. By the time anyone realized what was happening, it was far too late to stop him. A remote destruct existed, but its use might have been construed by the Shroud as an act of aggression, something no one wanted to risk. The decision was to let fate take its course. No one seriously expected to see Lascail come back alive, and though he did eventually return, his doubters had in a sense been right, because a large portion of his sanity had not come back with him. Lascail had come very close indeed to the Shroud before some force had propelled him back out again, perhaps only a few tens of thousands of kilometers from the surface, although at that range there was no easy way of telling where space ended and the Shroud began. No one doubted that he had come closer than any other human being, or for that matter any living creature. But the cost had been horrific.